The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI, Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at kuci.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Anteater Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
Good morning and welcome to this November 19th, 2014 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your host, Marie Stone. And as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week we are here with authors to talk about craft, content, and writing. I'm joined this morning by New York Times bestselling author Azer Nafasi, author of Reading Lolita in Tehran and her latest, The Republic of Imagination. And coming up in the second half hour, Lydia Millett will be here to discuss her novel Mermaids in Paradise. Azer Nafasi is the critically acclaimed author of Reading Lolita in Tehran, a long-running number one New York Times bestseller published in 32 languages, and Things I've Been Silent About, also a New York Times bestseller. She's a fellow at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. She's taught at Oxford University and several universities in Tehran. She appears regularly on major media and speaks to packed audiences around the world about the vital role of fiction as an antidote to ideology. Her latest is The Republic of Imagination, America in 3 Books. It's published by Viking, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Azer, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank goodness you've arrived, because you are sort of the spokesperson for a show like this, a show dedicated to literary fiction and to writing and to writers. You are the you're the anecdote we've all been waiting for. So thanks for coming on.
Well, I think it is a very reciprocal relationship, and that's why I feel that both the listeners and the true readers and writers should support and be ecstatic that there are shows like this.
I know.
That connect people and connect people who care about books, one to the other.
Right. Yeah, before we dive in to The Republic of Imagination, I wanted to talk a little bit about what the success of Reading Lolita in Tehran told you, or what it should tell us as the audience about the American reader, because it clearly tapped into something profound that I think we should be paying attention to. And I wanted to get your thoughts on what you think that was, why we were so hungry for that book, and kind of what it told you, the response to it, what that told you.
I'm so glad you mentioned this, because to tell you the truth, I'm always very skeptical about my books. And when I was writing Reading Lolita in Tehran, several colleagues and friends were telling me that this is really hopeless, because you're writing about Iran while we're entering a war with Iraq and everybody's attention is there, and you're writing about these dead white authors and nobody would read them, you know, and I believed them. But it was my obsession and I had to write it. The reader's response, and I'm not just talking about the fact that they bought the book. It was later on during my book tours and what they wrote and they emailed me and what they told me. It was one bright spot in the middle of a lot of things that were happening that I didn't enjoy. I felt that the readers were hungry for two things. One was the way Iran was being portrayed. Iran was and is still portrayed mainly in our media and through different discussions, even in our universities, through its current politics, and its representatives seem to be the Islamic regime. And I wanted to show people something about the other Iran, the real Iran, and how people lived there, and how resilient they were, and how also they were like the rest of the world, that the regime did not represent all the people. And I think that other image of Iran very much made the readers connect to those characters that I was writing about. And the second thing, and the miraculous thing, was the books. It was amazing to me that how many people in this country were hungry not only to read, but to connect through reading. They connected it to their lives, and it went against everything that many people now among our policymakers are saying about our system of education and books. In fact, people found these books profoundly related to their lives and relevant to their lives.
Right, right. Yeah, I was going to mention some statistics on reading. We're sort of preaching to the choir here because the show is dedicated to readers and writers. But Pew Research just reported earlier this year that only 25% of Americans, 25% of Americans had read no books, exactly zero books in the past year. And that's a figure that's tripled since 1978. But the people who read, read a lot. And I think, and most people do, obviously 75% do. And when The Atlantic reported on that statistic, they were more optimistic. And I was wondering your feelings about optimism. I know you have a lot of feelings about the Common Core that's coming into our educational system. But your feelings in general about Americans reading, and if you feel a surge of optimism or if you feel a little less hopeful for us.
Well, you know, there are two points here. One, I think one reason for the decrease in the number of people reading is because actually since late 1970s, in terms of our public life, in terms of our public education, we started seeing a sort of a denigration of reading or of works of imaginations or of humanities as if they were not really directly relevant to the prosperity and development in this country. And now, in the Common Core standards and other reactions, not just to libraries and bookstores and the act of reading, but to anything that has to do with imagination, with arts, with music. Our museums are also in trouble. We see that denigration in terms of our public lives, and I think that that does affect the way the public would react. On the other hand, I do feel hopeful. I might not be optimistic, but I'm very hopeful. And that hopefulness comes from having traveled over the past 11 years in at least 33 states, red and blue, big cities, small cities. And what I see is a thirst. I see that, especially among our youth, despite what is being said about them, I think they are not getting the meaning and the passion that they feel they deserve. And that is why I was focusing so much in this book on the need for public spaces where books can be discussed and where citizens can, freely exchange ideas and the works of and about the works of imagination.
Right. So let's go into the book. Let's talk a little bit about the Republic of Imagination, where it picks up from your prior discourse on reading and literature and fiction, and what inspired you to write this book.
Well, my editor keeps telling me that when I was finishing the last chapter on reading Lolita, my mind was already in this new book, and she was right. It took me 11 years and a book in between to finally write it. It was a very seductive and difficult book to write. But it all started right after finishing reading Lolita, because I wrote an article in Washington Post in 2004 that was called Republic of Imagination, where I discussed this. Then I wrote a short piece in Atlantic about Huck Finn and the idea of the founders, and I've been talking about Huck Finn since then. But I can I mentioned in the introduction to this book that when I was at the Elliott Bay bookstore in Seattle, this young man approached me during the book signing, and he was from Iran, and he had recently come to America, and there was so much despair in his voice when he told me that, you know, we're wasting our time here, that these people, meaning Americans, they don't care about books and such things. They're not like us who copied hundreds of pages of Madame Bovary or Huck Finn. And that question became very central to me. So does that mean that we only need to read books, that we only need imagination in countries that are oppressed, that democracies do not need a democratic imagination? And I felt that this needed to be investigated. And it needed to be investigated both through the books, but also both through the kind of reality, political, economic, and cultural, that we were living. And that is how the idea for the book sort of took off and ran away.
And it's this wonderful mix of memoir and personal stories, and as you say, polemic and discourse. And it's so uniquely done. It's so wonderfully done. My guest this morning. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to reannounce my guest this morning. For those just tuning in, is Azer Nafasi. The book is The Republic of Imagination, and you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'll let you jump back in. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I will jump in.
Okay. I'm really curious. I love this idea of getting to know a country through its literature before you know the country itself, that you were introduced to America through our fiction, and then you came, and then obviously you came and to America, and then moved to America. Talk a little bit about being introduced to a place through words rather than, you know, I don't know if you saw pictures or maps or things like that, but really being introduced through literature and fiction to the country you came to.
Well, you know, later on, when I was a child, I was not aware of this, but later on I discovered that if you really want to grasp the truth behind the reality of a place, the best place to go is to its fiction and to its literature and arts, as well as its history. But I was very lucky because during my childhood, my father, ever since I became conscious of myself as a person around 3.5 years old, he would tell me stories, and he was very democratic in the telling of the stories, because one day it was about Iran and the great mythologies of Iran and the fairy tales, and then the next day we would go to Italy, and I hear about Pinocchio, or France I hear about Little Prince, and the first time I heard about America it was through Wizard of Oz. And so you can imagine that for me as a child, America was Kansas. And Kansas, and at the heart of Kansas then, because it's described in that book as a desert, there was this lush, landscape, which was also America. And I discovered about the great thing about America, I think, and I'm more conscious of it now. I'm sure I wasn't conscious, although I got it when I was a kid, was the fact that these Americans protagonists like Dorothy, who like Huck Finn was an orphan as well, they are so resilient, and they discover who they are. They discover their own selves as individuals through probing, through going through a journey, and like what we're being taught now, that this is a dog-eat-dog world and all we care about is material success and money, and we shouldn't really care who we quash in this process. Would Dorothy, would Huck, would all these protagonists, they became more humane, and they became a real individual through connecting to others and through helping others, like Dorothy would the Tin Man and the Scarecrow and the Lion. And the fact was that they discovered that there is no superhuman, there is no wizard out there who is going to help them, that the wizard is within. And that is how they became self-reliant. And the other aspect of discovering America, I mentioned in the book, was through its musicals. Because my father also took my brother and I to a lot of films. Every week we would go to a new film. And again, you know, Egyptian, Turkish, French, Italian, and American musicals. And it was so weird to me that in the middle of, like, eating food, people are very politely sitting at the table, and then they all of a sudden get up and start singing, you know, and you know, and then of course the Persian movies were doing it then, and the Egyptians as well. It all came from America, I think, and it gave me a playful, whimsical dimension to America, and that is why when I came to this country and I tried to discover why were things the way they were, I couldn't find a better place than its fiction. And it responds to the statement you were making before about writing a mix of memoir and fiction, because from Iran I learned that fiction and reality are independent and of one another, but they're also interdependent. That fiction is at the heart of reality and not separate from it. And if I want to describe one, the best way I can do it is to describe one through the other.
We have that discussion a lot on this show, how fiction often reflects reality better than facts and nonfiction do most of the time. That's that's very well observed. Yeah, I'm wondering if you think the goal of fiction, because we talk a lot about that on the show as well, why write, why read? Mm-hmm. And some, you know, some say it's to feel less alone and less isolated, that somebody else has had this experience too. And some say it's to create order out of chaos, that the artist sees all the chaos of the world and tries to organize it. And I'm wondering if it's all of those things, but what it is to you and the real importance of it.
Well, it is all of those things to me, and that is the great thing about it. But there are two things to me that are very essential about fiction. First of all, what many today in this country, at least among our elite, believe, human beings need fiction in order to survive. You realize that one of the most important aspects of being human is this idea of curiosity, of wanting to discover the unknown and to control it, and there is an element of survival in it, and that is why, in fact, fiction and science are not segregated but very much related, because science is based on the desire to want to know about the material world, to control it, to make it more conducive to the way we live. And telling of the stories is also a search for the unknown, a search for the truth beyond the reality, and it is a journey of self-discovery. And it is a journey that tries to articulate the things that we cannot ordinarily articulate and connect human beings to one another. So fiction has curiosity and empathy, and both of these are central to the survival of us as human beings, which is why since the time of Greek and Roman mythology and Aeschylus and Sophocles and Euripides, to Bible and Torah and Quran and the religious fables and stories, to other forms of writing like novel and fiction, people have never given up expressing themselves and expressing the world through fiction, which is what gives me hope, because I think if nothing over the past thousands of years has been able to destroy fiction, to destroy storytelling, maybe nothing will in the present or in the future.
Hear, hear.
And also I think, of course, fiction is a guardian of memory, and that every moment we're dying, and it is through the telling of the stories that we, as Nabokov would say, leave conclusive evidence behind that we have lived. This is how we endure, and that is why it's important for our children to not only read Jonathan Franzen and John Pernahiri, but simultaneously read Herman Melville and Mark Twain in order to know who they are, who they were, and who they will be.
Mm. That's beautiful. My guest this morning is Azerv Nafasi. The book is The Republic of Imagination. You don't realize how American fiction is until you talk about American fiction with somebody who comes at it from a different perspective, a different cultural perspective. And you had an observation that American fiction focuses a lot on landscape more than other countries do. And that got me to thinking about that. What do you attribute that to?
Well, partly, Americans, the disadvantage in America as compared to Europe and other civilizations was that those civilizations had hundreds and hundreds of years of culture behind them. We, in America, there was no Shakespeare, there was no Dante or Moliere or Rumi. But the advantage was that they had to now create a new landscape, a new language, a new character for this new place. And I think that was the exciting thing that especially Huck Finn does. There are no other places in the world for Huck and Jim than that raft on the Mississippi River. As Fitzgerald and Arthur Miller and so many others talk about, Mark Twain wrote this novel as if nothing had ever been written before. And nothing had been written before about this. So he created Huck and Jim. Nowhere else in the world would you find Huck and Jim. Nowhere else in the world would you reverse the idea of safety and danger, because you realize that those towns that supposedly represent security and safety and civilization were poison to Huck and Jim. They were filled with violence. Every time they went on shore, they had to disguise themselves. But where was it that they felt secure? It was when they were in wilderness, where we tell our children not to go. And of course, the heroes, the language he created and the protagonists he created for this landscape were not lords and kings and queens. They were not, they did not belong to the upper echelons of society. The American heroes were usually orphans and outcasts. And they connected to the world through their heart. That is what makes me both love and breaks my heart every time I read a work of great American fiction.
America does love orphans. Disney loves to kill mothers off. And I hadn't focused on this fascination with orphans, but you're
That's
exactly
great.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's always best if your mother dies. I also want to talk about this relationship between the reader and the work versus the relationship between the reader and the writer. And I was watching an interview you did with, there's a whole panel, but I remember Jonathan Franzen was on there as well.
Yeah.
And you were saying that you didn't want to know the writer. You didn't want to know who he was. You didn't want to know what people thought of him. You really just wanted a relationship with the work. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that distinction, if it's an important distinction, the relationship one has to the work versus to the artist.
Well, why do we know all these authors? Why do we even want to know? Would we want to know Jonathan Franzen if he was an insurance salesman? We know him and we revere him, or we like him, or we even might dislike him because of the fact that he's the author of Corrections or Freedom or whatever else that he has written. And so for me, and I have realized through both my own interactions with artists and authors, and also from what I read in their biographies, that authors and artists are fallible. And there are many aspects of them that goes into their personal life or personal habits that I might not like. And there are some of them whose politics I disagree with completely. But when the work is great, it is great because it transcends its own time and the writer's own prejudices. And I always bring the example of Jane Austen because it's so easy. Some claim that she was very conservative. conservative. Some claim that she only talked about marriage. But Jane Austen is very subversive. That is why she has endured. At the center of each novel, there's a woman who says no to the dictates of her society and to the mores of her parents. And she says, I make the choice I want to in relationship to the man I want to live with. And she risks dire poverty in order to do that. So it is about making a free choice. It is about not becoming conventional. Marriage is a process, and there are many bad marriages in Jane Austen. There is criticism, self-criticism, because Elizabeth has pride and Darcy has prejudice, or vice versa. It is very democratic because it gives voice to every character, including the enemies, the people that we don't like. They all have a voice. So I feel that my first connection should be to the book and not to the author. Then later on, when I connect to the book and I love or hate the book, then I would like to find out more. It's like coming to a city. You know, you come to a city, you wander around, you find the monuments, you connect to the city, and then you become interested enough to go and read about the history of the city, to, you know, find out all the different aspects of it, which you had never known. But our first connection should be to the work and not to who wrote it or where it comes from.
Right, right. Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. Tell me, in The Republic of Imagination, you lived with this book for a long time. It sounds like 10 years from the yes. writing of the Atlantic article until now. What surprised you the most in the writing of it? What was revealed to you over the course of it that came as a surprise to you, maybe?
Well, the newness of it, you know, before you had asked me this question about landscape, and I remember that each of these novels, including Wizard of Oz and Baldwin, that I came across, when I reread them, I realized that the writer was creating a new place, like Babbitt is creating a new space for this new corporate mindset, this conformist mindset, and a new language. Carson McCullers, the small industrialized southern town, and Baldwin, of course, the new language of an African-American that we had never heard of before. So that was that newness I had not grasped before. And the second thing, which became very important to me, was the idea of morality. I realized how much the American novel was critical of the materialistic aspect of the American society from very start, and how nonconformist it was. The greatest American novels are constantly going back to the danger that threatens this country, which is complacency and conformity, which can also turn violent. And they become sort of like moral guardians of their country. They're far more important than some of us, not all, but some of us give them credit for.
Mm-hmm. Nothing does better for a book than to ban it, it seems, in American schools. You can guarantee that everyone will rush out and buy it.
You know, that gave me an idea that what we should do is we should really create a space on social media for students to have their own book groups and read only banned books.
Yeah, my daughter's school has a banned book week, and you have to read a banned book and you have to report on it. And it's a wonderful.
That's a great school.
You really
should be that way. And you know, by and by, we should ask ourselves, why is it that some of the greatest works that this country is proud of, that the world knows them by these great works, like Huxley or Great Gatsby or others, keep reappearing on the banned books list? They must be relevant to today if some people find them dangerous enough to ban them.
Right. I saw The Dictionary was now on the list of banned books, so you have Nothing is safe. No, it's true.
Really?
It is.
Well, you know, people think that absurdity comes from a place like the Islamic Republic of Iran, where they cut Ophelia from most of Hamlet. But no, absurdity is universal.
It is universal. It is universal. We're drawing down on our time, but do you have any words for all of our fiction lovers, fiction writers that we haven't covered today? Words of inspiration?
Well, you know, I feel that becoming a full citizen means that individual is at the center of things, not in a selfish way, but in a civic-minded way. That and I feel that the novel is there to tell us that to become a full individual, to enjoy the rights of democracy, you need to also take on the responsibility and voice. Do not remain silent. And the way that I studied this book, I studied the books in this book, I realized that every great movement in this country, every great change in this country, from the beginning of American Revolution through civil rights and civil war and gay rights and women's rights, comes from we the people. And I hope that communities of readers and those communities that depend on books and on reading will get together and not let what is happening to books today continue happening. I just want to have a national discussion that will be ongoing on how to bail out imagination and thought in America.
I wish I could take your course. I'm going to hunt you down and take.
Why don't we all create these courses and have a, you know, national debate around it?
Right, right. I think that's a fantastic.
You know, I mean it. I mean it.
Yeah,
I hope we'll do it. I know that people in this country, they have done, when they put their will there, they do what really is necessary to do.
Well, and with the internet, you know, it's opened up so many opportunities that weren't there before with online discussions, online classes. It doesn't matter where people are geographically located anymore. You know, this I certainly see this in our future. I really don't think it's a far-fetched idea at all.
Yes, we all, like Huck Finn, will decide that we risk going to hell but doing the right thing.
I love it.
That is the message.
That is the message. Azar Nafasi, thank you so... Oh, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to thank you.
Thank you. This was a huge pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time. That was Azar Nafasi, the book, The Republic of Imagination. We're going to take... You can find her online all over the place, of course. There are many wonderful interviews. She has a ton of YouTube videos that she does talking. You know, I could have talked to her for a lifetime, really. But you can look up more about her, certainly, online. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Lydia Millett will be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join other interviews up on the web and available via podcast. You can visit us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com. You can follow us on Facebook. We're under Writers on Writing, KUCI FM. You can follow us on Twitter. You can find us anywhere. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I'm joined now by Lydia Millett. Lydia is the author of 12 previous books of fiction. Her novel Ghost Lights was a New York Times notable book. Its sequel, Magnificence, was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle and LA Times Award in Fiction. Her story collection, Love and Infant Monkeys, was a Pulitzer Prize winning finalist, and she was a guest of mine back in January of 2010 for that book. It's my pleasure to welcome her back to chat about her latest novel, Mermaids in Paradise, published by Norton. Lydia, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for coming back. People usually don't agree to come back, so it's really nice of you to agree. They endure me once, and that's it. I never hear from them again.
Well, my wounds have healed.
Excellent. It only took 4 years, right? So tell us a little bit about Mermaids in Paradise. Take us into the novel. Nobody can introduce it better than you. So tell us where and how this book came to be.
Well, this is a story of a newlywed couple on their honeymoon in the Caribbean, and what happens is that they meet a marine biologist named Nancy who claims to have discovered real-life mermaids in a coral reef, and everything sort of descends into chaos from there. And, you know, I've just always been fascinated with mermaids, and I thought the perfect place to put them was right smack dab in the middle of a honeymoon, because mermaids are such oddly erotic fantasy symbols, and, of course, honeymoons are, you know, ostensibly this rite of passage devoted to sex, and so I thought they were a perfect pairing.
You know, so often those pairings come about after you're doing the writing, and your subconscious mind comes up with these really great links. Is that how that happened, or did you consciously think, wow, mermaids that are, you know, really sexual but can't actually have sex, and honeymoons that are full of sex, did you link those up in your head consciously, or did that come about where you're, you know, you look back over the course of 200 pages and say, hey, that's cool?
Well, I knew I wanted to write about mermaids. In fact, my young daughter had suggested I write about mermaids. And so I thought, I'll write a book called Mermaids in Paradise. And then everything just sort of evolved from there. I do, you know, my process of writing at least grown-up books, adult books, because I've also written a couple of children's books. But my process with these kinds of books is always sort of semi-conscious, or I don't know about unconscious, but I very, very little calculation goes into it ahead of time. So
right.
This was just where, you know, a story about mermaids had to go for me.
I really would love to take Deb out for drinks. Deb is the narrator of the book, and she's sarcastic. She's hilarious. She's certainly somebody you'd want to get to know. Tell me a little bit about you getting to know her, how you worked with her, if she gave you any problems,
Well, I always tell people, you know, if your characters are giving you problems, there might be a psychological issue there,
right?
Since they're, you know, made up constructs of your own imagination. So Deb was just sort of emerged as a voice at the beginning of the book, you know, when I sat down to write, sort of in this skeptical vein about a woman with a new husband that she loves, but who's completely different from her, and sort of. So the first part of the book is her talking about Chip, her incredibly, he's the world's friendliest man. You know, he's a video gamer, and he's a sort of extreme athlete, and also just full of love and hypersocial. And Deb herself is. Not hypersocial. She only likes a few people. She doesn't just talk to everyone she meets the way Chip does. And so there's this stark contrast between them, but also they really love each other. And I just thought it would be fun to play those kind of introvert and extrovert personality types off each other.
Right. Were there times that you've bumped on anything with her? What were the big challenges of this novel? Getting caught in the
plot. Well, you know, she had to sort of evolve a little bit over the course of the action from someone who's purely skeptical into someone who believes, at least believes in something, believes in this phenomenon of the mermaids. And so I guess the hardest thing was transitioning her to a place of belief from her position of skepticism and cynicism.
Right. So do you write it all the way through and then go back and revise so you have a draft to work with? Or tell me a little bit about that process.
Well, you know, I tend to just revise as I go along, because I revise more on the sentence level than on some big structural level. So, yeah, there wasn't so much after-the-fact revision in this book. I don't really work that way. I just go from one page to the next. It's very linear and simple-minded my process. I just go through the story myself, and each new page is as much a surprise to me as to the reader, I think.
My guest this morning is Lydia Millett. The book is Mermaids in Paradise. This might be a good chance. This is probably a good opportunity now that we've introduced the book for you to. Can you read a couple of pages for us so we can kind of get an idea of her lovely voice?
Sure. I'll read a couple pages just from the very beginning here. This is the first chapter of Mermaids in Paradise. It's called Newlyweds. Chip picked out the destination for our honeymoon. He'd always wanted to take a cruise, just like Middle Americans. Middle Americans love cruises, Chip said ardently. Chip's a romantic when it comes to the people of the Midwest, and also those dwelling along the Rocky Mountain front, the landlocked parts of the South, things like the Dakota area or what have you. Those places are somewhat mythic to Chip. He has what I suspect is a fanciful idea. People that live away from New York or L.A., D.C. or San Francisco, maybe in a pinch Boston or even Seattle, those people are modern-day pioneers. The Middle Americans are resolute, Chip thinks, living by choice in that vast featureless space, that oddly irrelevant no-man's land. They have their reasons, Chip believes, reasons we couldn't understand, or moral fiber, possibly. To hear Chip talk, you'd think every Nebraskan male knows how to put a horseshoe on a mule. They know how to bring forth grain from dirt, or what a combine harvester is. They get what happens to that brought forth grain, the steps before the Cheerios. The women knit long underwear and are adept at fruit canning. The best Middle Americans are like this anyway, pretty much old-fashioned, according to Chip. Their kids make charming toys from wooden boards, often with poking at nails in them. Not only that, those children are delighted with the products of their ingenuity. They go ahead and play with them. Those children wave a splintered board and think of marvelous fairyland. But Chip doesn't want to travel there in person to Middle America. That wasn't one of the honeymoon options. Chip's a romantic, not a moron. You don't have a Brentwood zip code and choose to spend your wedding vacation in Dayton. Literally no one does. From what I've seen, few people travel toward the middle of the country for personal reasons, unless a parent is dying. The two of us won't have to do that. Since my parents, may they rest in peace, are interred in the Bay Area. Chip's father was a deadbeat dad who left when he was 10. And Chip's mother, more for pity, has a condo near here. Chip just wanted to meet some of the hardy pioneers. He didn't want to physically go to the puzzlingly dull places where they live. He feared the religious hysterics, in addition, who inhabit the boring wastes and can be alarming. They frighten a person when gathered in groups or hordes, or individually. Chip talks about that quite a bit when not gaming. The fact that honest Middle America, once plodding along reliably with combines for the menfolk, homemade preserves for the women, and for the children some highly entertaining planks of wood, is now threatened by a growing subculture. A subculture so large it's bigger than the rest of us, actually. Which maybe means it's not a subculture at all, says Chip, with a worried aspect. That's where the fear comes in. The non-subculture is made of people who believe that fossils are a trick. These people are suspicious of biology and mortally offended by an ape. Also, they're angry about it. On the one hand, moral fiber, possibly. But on the other hand, madness. I'll stop there.
That was Lydia Millett reading from Mermaids in Paradise. It was funny because my husband's from Nebraska, so I had to read him that section. We can't change a light bulb by ourselves. So, this
I'm a bit
fantastic.
That way myself.
Yeah, I can't sew a button or change a light bulb. It's perfect. So we were.
I wasn't sort of raised to be handy. So I find it so marvelous when people are handy.
Yeah, no, I outsource most all of that, which is fine.
Exactly. And you live in a city, don't you?
I do. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Now, yeah,
exactly.
Right. But I didn't grow up in a city, so I don't really have any. I don't really have any excuses. So tell me a little bit about the reasons why we were talking a little bit in the first half of the show. The reasons why people write and what a writer's responsibility is to a reader or to society, and you feel imbued with some sense of responsibility over the course of your books that I've read. It feels they have a much more moral weight than just domestic marital honeymoon bliss. So tell me a little bit about what inspires you to write, what you feel like your responsibilities as writer are.
Well, that's a complicated and a very good question. I mean, my first responsibility is always to interest myself as I'm writing, and I think that is the first responsibility of every writer, never to be bored by her own work, never to feel that she's just biding time as she muddles through the prose. Always you should be intrigued and captivated by the prospect of what you might what you might make, you know, even if you're not satisfied with it in the end. So, and then I do think, you know, as I go through life more and more, I feel compelled to write about things that are hard to write about in fiction, things that are sort of larger social and political problems and really existential problems, things we grapple with but don't always discuss in fiction because writers have been taught that they're not advocates, they're not to take positions. And I'm just talking about sort of literary fiction writers as opposed to journalists or people writing serious nonfiction or whatever. So we're sort of taught that neutrality is part of the goal of fiction, and I reject that. You know, I don't think it's possible to be neutral. I don't think it's possible to be objective, and we've learned that in many disciplines that it's not possible to be objective, and so the guise of objectivity is a false one. And more as I get older, I feel I need to write about the hard things to write about, the things that are hard to talk about, you know, things that are intensely political and intensely charged. And so I do write more and more about matters like species extinction and climate change. And those things are sort of symbolically present in most of the work I do, if not directly present. So I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. Yeah, you had a wonderful quote that I can't totally quote because of FCC guidelines, but you were talking about how it's hard to write about these issues without coming across as a jerk, and mm-hmm. you have dealt with that problem by humor. Your characters are funny and quirky, and you can kind of laugh about it. But then you had the observation that maybe people don't take it as seriously because it's funny as opposed to, you know, some strict in the canon of literature. And I wanted your thoughts on that, if you feel like you have to undercut, I assume you just are very funny, so I assume that it's not, a burden for you, but if you have to undercut some of your messages to get them to be more palatable to the reader through humor.
You know, I certainly don't think of it that way. I think I just write toward humor when I'm in the mood to write that way, and there are other times when I write quite seriously and abstractly and sort of in an interior fashion about some of these things. But sometimes you just have to make yourself laugh, and sometimes laughter is the best response, the best personal response to some of these conundrums and some of these problems. I don't think it can ever be the only response, but I can't really write without humor. So even my more sort of earnest books fall back on humor at times and at moments, and sort of you're taken outside some of what's serious by this recourse to humor. But that's just, I think it's a matter of sort of voice and personality, and I just kind of can't live without it. I'm bored by books that contain no humor, and there are novels that really are devoid of humor out there, and I just find them somewhat tedious. So I just think some humor is just intrinsic to the human spirit. You know, it's just part of us, and I don't consciously, you know, seek refuge there, but I value it so much. I value laughter, and I like to make myself laugh loudly, even in public spaces as I'm reading and also as I'm writing. I just enjoy playing with stereotype and archetype too much to ever leave it aside entirely.
Yeah, me too. I was telling somebody that's the one number one thing that I value in friends and spouses and partners and things is humor. I mean, if it's very difficult to get through life without it.
Me too.
Life is too
hard. Me too. Me
hard.
Too. Yeah, life is just dreary without a sense of humor. And I think some people are social laughers, and some people are I don't know, private laughers, I guess, you know, like I know people who only laugh sort of when the people around them are laughing, but they don't laugh. Even if they're watching a funny movie or something, they won't laugh if they're alone watching it. But I've never been that kind of laugher. I've always just erupted into laughter spontaneously, whether they're people around me or whether I'm alone. I don't know if that's you too. And
that
if you know
me,
people who don't, I'm kind of mystified by it. Some of my good friends are like that. They just are social laughers, like social drinkers. They won't do it by themselves. But that's not. I could never exist that way.
Yeah, I have to cut those people out. I can't do that.
Merciless.
Merciless. Also, the people who don't socially drink, you have to cut them out too. That's very strict.
I know just what you mean.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier writing, you were on with me, we talked about short stories the last time with Love and Infant Monkeys. You've done some YA. You have obviously done a lot of adult fiction. Do you feel like there's a sort of a center of gravity where you're the most comfortable? I mean, I couldn't write a children's book. Somebody posed that to me because I have a child, and I said that would be of such a dark, horrible, you know, people would be in therapy forever. But do you feel you obviously feel comfortable in all of those genres? Do you feel like you have a center of gravity where you're pulled, or do you fluidly?
Well, I have to be honest. I'm not equally comfortable. I wish I were, but like you, I find children's fiction much harder than, you know, much harder than literary fiction. And I'm much more, I'm not ashamed to say, inexpert at it. I really just sort of, I started writing, so I wrote my first sort of book for middle readers, so that's like 9 to 12-year-olds, as a summer project, just sort of for fun, thinking that later my kids could read it because they were younger than that then. And then it turned into a small series, which I'm now trying desperately to wrap up with a third book, but it's much harder for me to write these kids' books, not because I write down to children or anything like that, or have to, it's because there's so much plot involved, and therefore you have to think ahead more than at least I do when I write books ostensibly more for adults. Mm-hmm. I don't really think ahead when I write this literary fiction. I just do what I feel called to do with each new page, as I was saying earlier. So, but with the kid stuff, it's, you get yourself into terrible tangles and twists, and then you have to extricate yourself from them if you're not a planner, if you're not a plot planner. So yeah, those books are much harder for me. The one YA book that I've written called Pills and Starships, which came out this summer, was a little easier for me because it's not a series and it's not as plot based, and so it was a more sort of just organic, fun effort for me, and I enjoy. It was joyful to write it more than the middle reader books, which are just they're so hard.
Yeah.
So I think naturally I much more naturally write for older readers, I guess. Even though I love children's literature, I love reading it, and I read YA books all the time, and I love reading that stuff as much as I like reading literary fiction. But it's just, yeah, it's a tougher place for me.
Seems like it'd be easier for yourself, your subconscious, to slip out in literary fiction, and you know, that's more dangerous for children to reveal that. At least for me.
Well, and it's just you just have to exert more control if you're writing. I imagine it's sort of like it is for, I don't know, mystery writers or people whose books are just intrinsically have to be carefully plotted.
Right.
I couldn't write that kind of genre either with any degree of ease. So. I think it's just this problem of having to plan things out, which I haven't done with literary fiction since I was in my 20s. When I wrote my first couple of books, I think I planned a little more because I was still feeling my way. But I don't like to write that way these days because it's just not as exciting to write a book that I've planned out in my mind.
Right.
Because I feel like I'm exercising a duty or something. I'm fulfilling an obligation to some kind of structure, and I don't like to do that. And so
it doesn't feel as organic, maybe, right?
I mean, I just don't. I'm not a careful builder of, I don't know, events and shapes and details. All that stuff I like to just wing.
Yeah, right. We're drawing down on our time, but do you have any, over the course of writing 12 novels, short stories, children's books, do you have any words of wisdom that you've garnered over the course of your career that you can share with our writing audience?
Well, actually, no, I just wrote like 5 tips for Publishers Weekly, and that's online. It's like 5 writing tips if you Google it. But and those are somewhat, you know, genuine sort of tricks of the trade, although I never would have written them without a nudge from that magazine. But I think the single most important thing is just to read a lot and to never, and I mean, you know this, but just to read a lot and read outside your comfort zone. Read things that are hard for you at first, and keep reading, and never think that you shouldn't be reading your contemporaries. You know, never think that you can write in some sort of void.
We lost Lydia, but One thing that she was saying that struck me is reading outside of your comfort zone is sort of like exercising out of your comfort zone. When your body and your brain get used to a particular thing, it becomes too easy, too comfortable. And if you switch up your routine, if you switch up your diet, just like if you switch up your books, a lot of good can come from that. You see things from a different perspective, and a lot can come from that. That was Lydia Millett. The book is Mermaids in Paradise. You can find her online. As she said, she has these 5 tips online of writing tips that would be fantastic to look up. That's all the time we have for today. I think Nicole will be here next Wednesday morning. Can't remember. Actually, next week is Thanksgiving, so I think we're going to do a rerun show next week, but we will be back here in December, Wednesday mornings, 9 a.m. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.